So.
How do you access that from, is it on campus? Or
which part?
Like, how do you get to the notes?
The notes?
Or like from the, is that the syllabus the link was on? Or was the how do you get to the website?
It's on the
syllabus. It's on the syllabus. But it's astroweb.case.edu/bjanish/astr221. I think you can get to it through the Canvas too. Somewhere there's a link, maybe. Other announcements. Looks like the weather will only be good on Wednesday. So we will attempt to do a class observatory night on Wednesday, meet at 8 p.m. on the quad. That's subject to change. We'll let you know on Wednesday if weather has changed. It's so hard to predict at this time of year, but we'll just be looking at like the moon and Jupiter and Saturn quickly, so it won't be too sensitive to clouds and stuff. Mark?
About how long will that be, like an hour long?
I'd probably stick around for an hour or two, depending on what the weather, but so if you can't make it right at 8, I'll probably be there till 10. David?
Where in the quad do we want to meet?
We want to meet right outside A.W. Smith. We might go over there later, so you'll see how to get there. If it's still clear in half an hour. Well, there's a sunspot today. It's a nice one, so we can go over and look at it. Unless there are review questions. Disincentive to asking questions. But yeah, the other thing on Wednesday is the midterm, right? So that's why we're doing review today if you want. In class, I'll provide blue books. I hope we have enough blue books. I'll have paper for you if not. In class, don't forget your cheat sheet, but don't cheat. You know what I mean by cheat sheet.
Don't forget your calculators.
Yes, and you can bring any kind of calculator. I don't care. I'm not going to be a weirdo about it. I personally prefer just like a 8th grade like TI-30X2S, but that's me. But yeah, you can bring a calculator, but no computers, phones, you know. I will be sitting and watching you, so, you know. You'll want plenty of writing implement, you know, if you have pencils and stuff, or you prefer pen, whatever. Any other procedural questions about anything? We talked about some exam stuff. Okay, last thing, don't forget there's a homework due at the end of the day today if you haven't already turned it in. Mark?
Sorry, another question. How do you want this to turn it in? Can we just submit like a PDF of like our code and like the pictures or like just the...
You don't need to show me your code for this assignment. Okay. Just show me your plots, in which case you can put it in a PDF in the same way you were turning in the handwritten stuff.
Yeah. And if you can make it a single PDF, I'm sure Ray will appreciate that too.
Can we do it like in a Google Doc and then like submit to Google Doc for Canvas?
Export it to a PDF.
Yeah. Export it to a PDF and submit.
I don't think you can. I don't think it's. Yeah. Canvas won't let you do that. You have to have a PDF.
Like that.
Oh.
Let me.
Okay.
You can take things from your drive.
Oh, maybe. I don't know. As long as there's a PDF where you can grade.
Yeah.
Okay. However it works. Canvas is weird. I don't understand how it works half the time. So, okay. We just have one more topic to cover that will appear on the exam. So we're going to talk about that now. So this is a hint, hint, wink, wink, nudge, nudge. This will be on the exam. So we left off last time talking about this idea of turning 4 hydrogen atoms into a single helium atom in the sun. And the reason that that is useful for the sun to power itself is that there is a mass difference between a single helium atom and a hydrogen atom, and the difference in mass is ended up converted to energy by this process, right? So I wanted to go through and actually describe the specific steps in the process, because it's not just taking four protons and turning it into a helium, right? There's multiple steps and different routes and different paths you can take depending on the conditions and just probabilities. So what this process is called is the name of it is the proton-proton chain. The name of it is, it's kind of a weird name, right? But hopefully that will make sense why it's called that when we're done talking about it. So just to be clear that we're all on the same page, right? When we talk about a proton, what we really mean here is that we're talking about a hydrogen nucleus, right? That's what a proton is. It's just the one proton. So when I write that, I'll write it as 1H, to be clear, like that. And then when I write 4 helium, like this, what we really mean for 4 helium is that there are 2 protons and 2 neutrons in like a, however the atomic structure is. I'm not a atomic physicist, so it's all probabilities and stuff. One other thing that we need to know to make sure that this works is that the temperature inside the sun at the core where the actual fusion process is happening needs to be higher than 10 million Kelvin for this to work. So it can be higher than 10 million Kelvin. Like, it's not like a precise number. It has to be exactly this to work, but it has to be at least greater than 10 million Kelvin. Okay. So, step one. The very first thing you're going to do is take 2 protons, 2 hydrogens, and smack them together. So that's 1H plus 1H, and that yields something. Why is this a particularly difficult thing to do? Why do we need something like the core of a star? High temperature, 10 million Kelvin. The pressure, remember, at the center of the sun is like 150 billion atmospheres. Why do we have to have such extreme conditions for this process to happen? Kevin?
They're both positively charged particles.
Right. Those things are both positively charged, right? I don't have magnets, so we could do like a demonstration, but it's hard to bring 2 light charged things together because they push each other apart, right? So the real problem here is in the nucleus of an atom, the Coulomb force is the predominant force keeping things from getting too close to each other, close enough to do fusion. But then once you overcome what we call the Coulomb barrier, things will really stick together really strongly because of what we call the nuclear strong force, right? That's what keeps the nuclei of atoms together. So to be able to overcome that Coulomb barrier, we have to get the protons themselves moving very quickly so that they don't have enough time, basically, to experience the repulsion force from having the same charge. So that's why we need such extreme conditions. So once you've actually done that, right, you've overcome your Coulomb force, and you fuse these 2 protons together, you get something called 2H, or deuterium. And a deuterium is equal to a proton and a neutron. So we've essentially changed one of the protons into a neutron and then stuck the 2 together. We also, so what we have to do is conserve the charge of this reaction. So the way we're going to do that is that additionally in the products, we have a positron, which is a positively charged electron, and then something called a neutrino, which I'll represent with the Greek letter nu, like that. So the positron is helping to conserve the charge here, and the neutrino is sort of along for the ride. It has to, it's part of the changing into a neutron reaction. So you'll notice here that there isn't any explicit energy change on the two sides of this reaction, right? We don't have anything here that's representing a photon yet. There's no energy been produced by this. All we've done is change one proton into a neutron. So step two is where we start to produce some energy. Step two, you take the deuterium you just made, and it encounters a regular hydrogen, and then that reaction produces helium-3 and a little bit of energy in the form of a gamma ray photon. So helium-3, that's equal to 2 protons and 1 neutron. And the gamma ray photon has really high energy, right? We talked about gamma rays having very short wavelengths, very high frequencies. That translates to really high photon energy. Okay. So we've got something that's called helium now, but it's not the right kind of helium. We're looking for helium-4. How are we going to do that? You might think, okay, let's tack on another proton, and we're good to go, right? Well, not quite, right? We have to have 2 protons and 2 neutrons in there. So between step 2 and step 3, really what we want to talk about is the fact that we have to repeat step 1 and step 2 again to get another helium-3. So now you have, at the end of repeating step 1 and step 2, 2 helium-3. A couple positrons, a couple neutrons, a couple gamma rays, but the 2 helium-3 is the main thing that we're interested in here. And then we get to step 3. Step 3 can actually take one of a few different routes, depending on the conditions, depending on the flip of a coin, I guess the roll of a die, not really the flip of a coin, but whether it's a little bit hotter, a little bit colder, right? In the sun, the most common route that step 3 will take, which happens 69% of the time, is that you'll take the 2 helium-3s that you have and smash them together, and then you get helium-4 plus 2 hydrogen ones, regular old hydrogens. So now you're left with what you're looking for plus two of what you started with. So you'll note if you look at sort of the recipe of what's here, right? So this is two protons and two neutrons, and this is a proton and that's a proton, and you had two protons and a neutron, and two protons and a neutron, so you are balanced on both sides there. All you've done is shuffle around where what atom those constituent parts are in. So that would be an end to the process, right? We've gone from four, we've actually taken six hydrogens to do this, right? You have one, two, three in each branch that you need, and you end up with a helium four, and then two of those protons are just sort of used as catalysts as to do that process. So that's why I think that's why we call it the proton-proton chain, is because we end up with two protons at the beginning and the end of that. They're used as catalysts to produce helium four. So that's the most common route. A question. Where does the neutron come from? The neutron comes in the very first reaction when we took two protons and stuck them together. In that reaction, one of the protons turned into a neutron by giving off a positron. So the positive charge goes away there. And then you're left with the neutron. David?
What happens to the positron?
What happens to the neutrinos?
Yeah.
Neutrinos don't really interact with matter very well. They're a special bunch, neutrinos. And so once you produce the neutrino, it basically just, whatever direction it was going, it just goes, keeps going forever.
The saying is that it can pass through a light year of solid lead before hitting a single particle. Look at your hand right now, there's about a trillion neutrinos passing through it every second.
Yes. And you will never observe a single one of them. Joanne.
So, like, how do they know that happens? Like, if they don't do anything, do they just put that as, like, a placeholder? Or, like,
so,
do they know what it is, really?
Right, so that actually is a way that we can test that this process actually happens. So there are ways to detect neutrinos. So basically, I think the most common way is to go down in like a mine or something and build a big tank full of a noble gas, so like xenon or argon or something, like 10 swimming pools of liquid argon or xenon, and that will catch one in a trillion neutrinos and cause a little phosphorescent reaction to happen. And if you understand your detection process, how you detect those phosphorescent reactions, how you convert that to from the number that are passing through to the number that you can detect, if you understand all of that, you can convert that into a neutrino flux, how many are passing through that detector at a given time. And that number gets pretty close to how many we expect to be coming out of the sun at a given time from the proton-proton chain reactions. So we can detect. So you can sort of say, okay, we have my neutrino detector. There's some amount of directionality to it, and if you look towards the sun, that's where most of them come from. So that's a way of detecting neutrinos. A bunch of people over in physics do that stuff, so they would be great people to ask about the fine details of how it works. That's as much as I know. Eric, you have your hand up.
Yeah, so I've got a question about the positron.
Yeah.
So does that, like, annihilate with an electron? Does it go out into space?
It will almost immediately annihilate with an electron.
Gotcha.
Because the core of the sun is full of free electrons. So that reaction will produce an energy in itself, just having the positron plus the electron, they'll meet up and they'll be like, okay, great, now we're energy.
Okay, that makes sense.
So that's another source of energy here. Nathaniel.
Does that account for like a significant amount of
I don't remember what the energy of a positron-electron pair is. I don't think it's as much as the photon you get out of the... It might be on the same order. I'm going to have to look that up. That would be a good thing to know. David.
And so, this first step, the reason that happens is because the Coulomb force of repulsion between the two is stronger because of the high gravity of the sun. Is that true?
The...
You said you just needed a really strong force to be able to overcome the Coulomb.
So yeah, it's less about the force and more about the high velocity of the protons that you're using.
Okay.
So it's more that if you move fast enough, if you happen to cross each other's path, you are going too fast for the repulsion to have an effect.
And so if there's also a sea of electrons, is that the same reason that the H's just don't grab? They don't become neutral.
Like, if
there's a lot of electrons and there's lots of
right,
positive.
But it's remember that it's 10 million Kelvin.
Yeah.
And you only need to be like 10,000 Kelvin to start to ionize the electrons.
Okay,
out.
So that's okay.
So there's no way
so the
that there's the chance of a hydrogen, a proton grabbing an electron are really low. It happens because there are a fuck ton of them.
Yeah.
In the core of the sun. But
very little compared to
that is a proper unit that I'm using there. Right. So it happens a lot, but as a proportion of what's there, it's minimal.
Yeah.
Because it's just too hot. Because the photons that are floating around are tens, hundreds of times the ionization energy. So they can't stick around. Okay.
31% of the time, I'm rounding a little bit, there's a third option, which is even less. 31% of the time, if you have some helium-4 floating around already, you can take a helium-3 plus a helium-4 and stick them together, and make a beryllium-7 plus a little bit of energy. And then if that beryllium captures an electron, it can decay into lithium-7 plus a neutrino. So basically what's happening there is one of the protons in the beryllium is turning into a neutron by capturing the positive charge from the electron versus the negative charge. So the negative plus positive cancel out and make a neutron. So it's like the inverse of the very first step. The proton is not splitting into a positron and a neutron. It's taking the positive charge plus the negative charge makes a zero charge. And then if you tack on that 7 lithium plus a hydrogen, that will split into 2 helium-4s. So that's another potential path you can go down. So 31% of the time. So about 70, about 30. And then the final option, which happens 0.3% of the time. If you take that beryllium-7 from up here, and add on a hydrogen, you get a boron-8 plus a little bit of energy. The boron-8 decays on its own, just sort of sits there. It says, I don't like being boron 8. I want to be beryllium 8 instead. So it turns into beryllium 8 plus a positron plus a neutrino. And then that beryllium 8 splits into two helium 4s. I ran out of space at the bottom there, but.
And those are nus and those are neutrinos?
The nus are neutrinos, yes. Shubika.
The 31% of the time one, where did the 4 helium come from?
This one?
Yeah.
It's a product of an earlier reaction, or a different reaction. So you have, basically you're taking a bucket of hydrogen and turning it into helium, so once you've done a reaction, it's sort of sitting in there,
okay.
And it can interact with any of the other things that are there.
And then what affects how often one of these processes occur?
It's random chance, basically. Quantum mechanics, think about it that way. Just one of these will happen. So if you sat and you watched 100 of these happen, 69 of them would be step or branch 1, 30% would be branch 2, and maybe 1 would be branch 3. It's just probabilistic statistics, yeah. Steve?
Is there a term for when the 8 beryllium changes to 2 of the helium 4s?
There is a name for it. I don't remember the word. Do you, Ray?
Scroll down. That's beta decay. And the opposite is beta capture.
Beta decay. Wait, is it beta? Do you, Steve, do you mean this one?
Yes.
Oh, that's not.
That's not beta decay. Is that spallation?
Yeah.
Is that what that's called? I have to look that up. There are any chemists in the room that might know.
The boron 8 to beryllium 8, that's beta decay.
Right.
And the opposite, where it absorbs an electron, like the beryllium 7 and the electron, that's beta capture.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Because the particle that you're working with there, right, the electron part of that was historically known as a beta particle. So that's what we call it, beta decay or beta capture. Incidentally, a helium 4, that's often called an alpha particle. So if you hear about alpha radiation, they're talking about helium nuclei. There are also a ton of those going through you at any given time. So watch out for helium. Just the sun is spitting out a bunch of them. I will double check the definition of spallation. So we have names for the three branches. They're just PP1 with a Roman numeral, PP2 or PP3, like so. There's a flow chart I can put here that will sort of show how this works. But I have to find it. Bear with me a second. Flow chart.
So here is basically the path you can take. These first two reactions always have to happen, right? You have to get to a helium 3 somehow. But then what happens with the helium 3 is the first choice that can happen. If you interact with another helium 3, that's the regular old PP1 branch. If you interact with helium 4 and turn into a beryllium 7, then you have two choices with what happens to the beryllium, and that's PP2 or PP3. Those choices there. So basically, if you take all these reactions and sort of boil it down to what the basic thing that has happened here, right, is that we've taken 4 hydrogen nuclei and turned it into a single helium atom, an alpha particle, 2 protons, 2 neutrons, and then you've gotten out 1 positron, 1 photon, and 1 neutrino as byproducts of those reactions per 4 protons. And then if you do one of these other two things, you might get an extra positron or photon or neutrino, depending on what you do. So that's the PP proton-proton chain. Any questions? Sean?
Like the right branch necessitates the left branch, right?
This part, you mean?
Like, since we got that
right.
4 helium, we needed this left step to happen in order to get the second.
Right. Once you make a beryllium, you have to figure out a way to get helium out of it again. And so you either do one of those two things, yeah. This 99.7 and 0.3 basically are out of 31%. So this happens 69% of the time, and then 31% of the time you get a beryllium, and then you do one of those two things, but mostly this over here. I hope that answers your question. Steve?
What's the subscript?
Oh, it's an electron neutrino, is what that means. There's different kinds of neutrinos depending on. Yeah, we're not even gonna get. We don't want to talk about the standard model. Not yet, anyway. Yeah, because then you have to start wondering about what dark matter is, and we're not ready for that yet. Not looking good for the standard model these days, guys. It's not good. Jake, right?
Yeah. Is the sun hot enough to fuse things like larger than beryllium?
Eventually, it will get hot enough. But we haven't gotten there yet. So when we come back, we'll talk a little bit about how we get the photons out now. Now that we've made them, how do you get them to come out of the sun? And then we'll talk about evolution and what happens in later steps in the sun or other stars' life. But basically what happens is when you run out of hydrogen to turn into helium, the star has to account for that somehow, and it heats up. It contracts and heats up in the core, and so that lets you it gets hotter and you can do other things. So helium will then turn into carbon and oxygen and nitrogen are all part of the sort of this next step. And then that's it for the sun. Basically, you have carbon in the center and then you're done. But higher mass stars can get up to iron eventually. Any other questions about the proton-proton chain? Garrett.
Uh-huh. That doesn't like stick around, right? Like it always gets turned back into helium 4, like
right. Yeah.
Very quickly. So it doesn't like collect
the sun. No. In fact, lithium is really difficult to keep around at high temperatures. And so if you can have like trace amounts of lithium on the surface where it's only like 6,000 Kelvin, and that's
pretty rare. Yeah. Steve?
The proton, I'm sorry. The proton-proton chain is really only used to illustrate how the sun manifests helium-4, because I don't see any releases of energy besides some gamma.
Well,
is this just to illustrate the production of helium, or like,
both, right? So these are really high. We have to figure out the actual these photons are. What's the number? 26.71 mega electron volts per photon, which is a lot of energy for a photon. They're, you know, gamma rays. You wouldn't want to encounter the gamma ray by itself out in space. It would end badly for you in your DNA. But you, what you have to remember is how many of these reactions are happening in the sun. Because we're talking about 4 hydrogen atoms turning into 1 helium. But how many hydrogen atoms are there in the sun? Maybe this is a good quick discussion question. How many hydrogen atoms are there in the sun?
At least 6.
At least 6. So, quickly, look up the mass of the sun. So in groups, right, you want to know the mass of the sun and the mass of a hydrogen atom, and so how many hydrogen atoms are there? Okay. Call it 10 to the 57. We'll just do order of magnitude here, right?
Yeah.
There's 10 to the 57 hydrogen atoms in the sun.
Well, yeah, actually, that's if 100% of it was hydrogen, so it'd actually be a little less.
So take 75% of that.
Yeah.
So it's still 10 to the 57.
Yeah.
If we only use a tenth of it to actually turn into helium, so that's 10 to the 56. And you have to have 4 to do a reaction, right, to turn into 1 helium. So that's 10 to the 55. And if so then you have 10 to the 55 reactions throughout the lifetime of the sun, which is 10 billion years, right? So that's 10 to the 10 years that happens. So that's 10 to the 45 reactions per year. And then, you know, how many per second is that? 10 to the pi times 10 to the 7 seconds, right? So that's 10 to the 38 reactions per second or so. right? And if 10 to the 38 reactions per second times 26 MeV, that's 10 to the 39 MeV per second that you're making. That's a lot.
It's at least
6. Right? At least 6. So, Steve, I hope that answers your question.
That helps a great bit, thank you.
Yes. This is happening a lot in the sun. And this reaction happens, like, very rarely, too. But, you know, given any interaction, right? If only, if you have 10 of the 57 hydrogen atoms in the sun, and per second, like, 10 to the 39 of them are doing something, or 10 to the 38 per second, that's not a great percentage, right, David?
Is this from, this all from gamma, like, rare radiation?
Yeah, so this is just from the gamma radiation from the proton-proton chain,
yeah,
the second reaction.
So
that's not counting electron annihilation.
Yeah. So how does that energy get transferred to the, like,
protons? Ask me again on Monday.
Okay.
That's the next step.
Okay.
But a combination of radiation and convection slowly over the course of 100,000 years. Okay. Are there any review questions that we want to talk about? Or do you just want to go look at a sunspot? Mark?
I do have a question. Like, how, I know since we have the cheat sheet, how are you going to be giving us any context on the needs on the next question? Or should we have those already?
You should probably want to have those. Yes. Should be good. If you need to know that, I will give it to you for the question. But I would say you'll want to know things like what the value of G is in all the different combinations of units. What's the what the mass of the sun is in kilograms, that sort of thing. Like the constants you're going to want to have. Joanne?
Is there like a good place to find out like what units for what equations? Because like it changes a lot.
I would say I think that you, if you default to astronomy units, you'll be fine.
Okay.
So solar masses, years, AUs, that sort of thing.
Okay.
If you work problems in those combinations of astronomy units, you should be fine to convert at the end. If it asks for something in kilograms or watts or something, yeah.
Do we need to know like derivations for like couple of them stuff or just the derivations?
There are a few derivations that are valuable to know. We talked a lot about magnitudes, right? Wink, wink, nudge, nudge.
Wait, when you say magnitudes,
anything related to magnitude. I'm being purposefully vague, but
the derivation for mag, like equations for mag.
I'm not going to say anymore. It's a valiant effort, though. Good job.
I'll be around all day tomorrow, in my office hours and through email, and just stop by if you have any questions. I'll be around all day.
Yes, I will not be here tomorrow, alas. But you can also email me if you have particular questions, but I will be here Wednesday morning before the exam. Right.
I forget, did you say we can use front hand back like a piece of paper?
Yeah.
Okay.
Do whatever you want with a sheet of paper.
Okay.
You could just print a picture of your cat on it for all I care. Make a paper airplane. One of those things that you do in elementary school you could just have it randomly generate the answers for you, that'd be fine. It's a bad idea. Who wants to go look at a sunspot? Okay. Let's go look at a sunspot.